Welcome to the McGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, mcguffinmen.com, if you want to keep up on our past episodes. We most recently discussed Gentleman Broncos, Margaret. God, these are going to be, like, we're getting numbers. We're getting ratings over here with these topics. The Apartment before that, and Tully prior to that. And I've also written a handful of things recently. And you can read those if you like. TheMcGuffinMen.com.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Alex.
Here we are. We're back.
Here we are with a Halloween episode about the slight corruption of a new politician.
It's so spooky.
We're talking about the candidate from 1972.
Yes.
With a young Rob Redford, not at the height of his powers yet.
Oh, I like that he's Rob Redford now.
It's cash over here.
I don't disagree with the being casual. This is a new turn in how you discuss Robert Redford to me.
So Bobby R in this one.
Yes, Bobby Red.
Bobby Reds. No, but it's 1972. I mean, this is after Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, but he's not quite the Robert Redford. I mean, as far as kind of fame and respect as he will be at one point, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think when he dies, the first, like, most eulogies will run if we're looking at images from movies, the first one is All the President's Men, you know, which is still 4 years away at this point. So, like, that's his defining movie, and we have not gotten to his defining movie. That's where we are. But he's still extremely famous and is definitely a movie star. You know, like, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is 69. Downhill Racer is the same year. I think, like, within weeks of each other, those two movies opened up. It's a real Shia LaBeouf, Disturbia, Transformers 1 sort of situation, if you will. I think that's how it was described in the press at the time.
Yeah,
it was Shia situation.
And in film textbooks for a
year. Yeah. David Bordwell wrote that initially, I think. But 69 is really where Robert Redford starts to become famous. But, I mean, it's still Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in 1969. You know, he's the second banana to Mr. Newman at that point still.
Right.
Yeah.
And speaking of Downhill Racer, this is directed by Michael Ritchie.
Mm-hmm. The Candidate and Downhill Racer, both directed by him.
Yes. Right. And we'll say this is written by Jeremy Larner, who kind of knew his way around politics and was a speechwriter for Eugene McCarthy in 1968 Democratic presidential nomination. And I thought there was somebody else on here who they had on for his... Oh, it was Michael Ritchie, actually.
Yeah, Michael Ritchie worked in...
Technical advisor, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So this is a movie, you know, this is very much about politics, and so they got some people who were in the know, and not politicians, but the behind-the-scenes people, which is a large part of what this movie's about, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, just not necessarily the behind-the-scenes people, but the behind-the-scenes process, you know, and just to show that process, you need the people, you know? Although the first prominent character we are introduced to is that, I mean, I feel like Puppet Master is going a little far, but that Peter Boyle's Puppet Master type character, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what brought this one on for you? What made you want to talk about The Candidate?
Oh, I mean, I think it's a fantastic movie. I'm always happy to talk about Robert Redford, just in general.
70s,
yeah. I've always really liked Downhill Racer as well, but I don't think it's worth us doing a podcast about it. I think there's a lot of stuff in this about competition and aspiration that I really like. I like looking at Robert Redford for 110 minutes. I feel like everybody does.
Sideburns 86, they're un-86.
I think my Redford is the the post sideburns Redford, but it's still like his haircut in this movie still leaves something to be desired. But I don't know what my exact ideal Redford is. I think it's probably in a press photo somewhere. But
I do like that 70s get rid of your sideburns just means to the bottom of your earlobe.
Yeah, I know exactly. Just give yourself a half buzz cut, like halfway up your head. Then the hair can be super long around it.
Oh, man.
No, and I mean, for a movie that was made in 1972, I feel like this movie addresses the media directly a lot in ways that felt very ahead of its time, and or at least my perception of ahead of its time for 1972. But also, I feel like this movie, like depending on when you watch it, it gives you a different feeling towards certain scenes. Like the first time I watched it, President Obama was the president, you know, and now he's not. And when I first watched it, and I wrote this because I was writing something about Robert Redford at the time, it felt like a movie about the 2008 election the first time I watched it. And now it feels entirely different. And also I can see how I thought that before. But I would imagine somebody watching it today for the first time doesn't really think that much about Obama, you know. And I don't know. I just think it's a very interesting movie. It's very interesting how much of it can still seem modern, despite the fact that a lot of the delivery devices have changed. You know, like there's no social media equivalent in this movie because it's 1972. But yeah, I enjoy that stuff, and I think there's just time honored themes of humanity involving like aspiration and competition that I think are portrayed really well here that don't always get shown in such an interesting way.
Yeah, it's an interesting little movie, like just as a sort of self-contained unit. I personally just had kind of a hard time getting my arms around what it was. And it's, you know, this isn't a really abstract movie, you know, like told out of order with a bunch of weird visuals that you can't quite understand.
Yeah, it was basically that sequence in the mall is about the only time it really gets abstract.
Yeah, and even so, I mean, it's you know everything that's happening. You see that you're that this feeling this feeling of disorientation that he's going through mm-hmm. is being conveyed to you.
Yes,
you know, effectively, but you know, not in the way that some movies try to convey disorientation, where you really do feel kind of very lost or you know nauseous or you know just some kind of storytelling that really throws you off. I mean, I think it gets affected to, gets communicated to you effectively, as I said, but it's really not that wild. You know, we see crazier movies from the 70s and 60s for sure. You know, this isn't, you know, a trip out movie or a psychedelic movie by any means. Like it's nowhere close, but, it's really not right down the middle. And I've just in the last, you know, days of reading about it, I don't know. It people say it reminds every, and it, whenever people are writing about it, they say how ahead of its time it is and how it feels like it's written kind of just for this moment. Mm-hmm. And I think when something is not so right down the middle, you know, as you said, the technologies that we, if you were to make or try to make a movie saying the same thing as the candidate now, as you said, there'd be so much social media, there'd be mm-hmm. all these different things. So it would seem a lot different, but it's successful in kind of conveying that without getting stuck on the specifics.
Yeah, and like even just thinking about basically any situation where there's some sort of, I mean, presidential races are the only things that I can think of because that's the only time I really follow politics particularly closely. But like anytime there's a candidate that's viewed as like the younger of two options, I'm thinking of like Bill Clinton on MTV playing saxophone is a perfect example of a scene that would have been in The Candidate if it had been made in 1992 instead of 1972. And yeah, I think that just sort of goes to the point of, it's kind of amazing how like just all of the, you know, all of the outlines of people in this movie have stayed kind of the same, still apply to a lot of different situations. And, the movie somehow, or maybe it's just the nature of politics. It's just non-committal in general, like when you're in the election phase, that it just always sort of stays relevant, and just the things that haven't been updated are technology, because technology didn't exist yet.
Yeah, and I just see
this particular technology. Hammer's technology.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just see people talking about this as a satire, and a lot of people have kind of said the same thing, that maybe we don't, modern viewers don't see the satire in it as much because of movies like Wag the Dog or Primary Colors that are really, I guess, over the top is the phrase to describe it. Like, you know, and they kind of talk about Network the same way, that there might just be too much subtlety here, that this is a good kind of satirical expose of a past moment in time, that now politics are so extreme that it no longer fits.
Yeah, I can see that. I also feel like it always bears mentioning that most comedy just doesn't age the way its creators might want it to, you know, like, I don't know, what's the funny, 1978, I think, is Animal House, right? Like, watch Animal House now, like, the laughs per minute just do not translate to at a pace that you would anticipate. And so many things that would have been funny in 1978, like, people like you and I just wouldn't understand because we were not yet born. And I just think, like, comedy of pretty much any genre of film is the type that the comedy just disappears quicker than the drama would ever disappear from something, you know? Just because I think it's so dependent on, I guess, where society is at the time, where what is funny at the time is, you know, all these things. And I definitely understand where people that would say that are coming from. Because I agree that this doesn't feel like a comedy. But I also...
I don't see it at all. Like,
no, I don't see it as a comedy at all. I don't.
Jokes. There are funny parts, but there's funny parts to, you know, Batman or,
yeah,
you know, jokes in Saving Private Ryan. There's jokes in every movie pretty much. But
I also
few and far between.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think like satire necessarily has to be funny. You know, like that's the other thing that I see with it. Whereas maybe this would make very cynical 30-somethings such as yourself and I have laughed very hard in 1972. Now it makes me want to cry or something like that. And but I mean, there's really no way to know. But I do think that an important distinction to make anytime the term satire comes up is that just because it's satirical doesn't mean you're laughing.
Yeah. And but just another thing kind of on that about it just not seeming, you know, it's not the movie that I thought it was going to be. And that's not a dig at this movie. You know,
yeah, like, I mean, this movie, there aren't a lot of movies like it.
Yeah. And I've been, you know, I'd say that as a positive things about many, many movies. You know, you can be very pleasantly surprised by a movie that didn't do what you thought it would do. And, you know, I kind of joked about it at the beginning, but if this is the story about the candidate, if this is the story about a man who has these very ideal views of life, who gets caught up in the machinery of party politics and gets kind of corrupted and disillusioned by the end, which I think in broad strokes this movie is, that movie doesn't look like this, you know. It's the signs of his corruption and the moral decay that this movie seems to be charting doesn't show up on screen the way other movies trying to tell that broad story makes them show up. Am I right about that?
I agree. I don't feel like this movie also, like, if we're talking about ways that this doesn't feel like, you know, any other or every other movie is, it doesn't have a pronounced three-act structure. It does sort of feel like there's very little hand-holding. There's very little score. There's a credited composer. I could not tell you what scene their work appears in. Sort of like Carter Burwell in No Country for Old Men, I guess. But
Lockmaster Carter Burwell.
Yeah, exactly. That mariachi band and nowhere else. And that's usually a really good sign for anytime somebody wants to convey an emotion without words, you just use music. And there's no, and a lot of the times it feels like a change happens with McKay very quickly, and there's no way to that it's really signified in a way that I would point as being obvious. Like it just sort of halfway through the scene, you're like, oh, I guess this has changed, and then you sort of start to think about it, and you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like there are scenes where, you know, characters go off to this. Usually it's Peter Boyle, his character whose name I cannot remember, pulling McKay aside, Bill McKay aside, specifically in the bathroom at the primary victory party, and they just have a quick conversation about, you know, like, you're gonna get humiliated, you know, you're gonna get destroyed by Jarman, and that you're gonna have to do all of these things. You're gonna have to start talking to people that you haven't been trying to reach up to this point. You're gonna have to do more TV, all this stuff. And then we see him do more TV and all that stuff. Those are moments where it's more like standard Hollywood movie. But then there's the moments where earlier in the film where Boyle is trying to convince McKay to run in any capacity. They're having a beer at his house. Excuse me. He says, you're gonna lose, so you can say whatever you want. All this stuff, like, McKay's still not sold. And then he goes to Jarman's a rally that Jarman's holding, and he shakes his hand as Jarman's walking out and doing the whole shaking hands, kissing babies thing. McKay shakes Jarman's hand, and he says something like, oh, we may have met before, or something like that. And I don't even know what Jarman says, but it's something so just like, okay, moving on sort of thing, like like polite, but like, this is over simultaneously. And yeah, then, you know, we just get this close-up of Redford, of McKay, and then just smash cut to him standing in front of cameras announcing his candidacy. I mean, cut to him like in his office telling camera operators to turn the lights on, he's ready to speak, and what he does is announce his candidacy. And that is something that happens, obviously, but it happens in such a jagged, sudden way. But we don't really feel, we aren't told about McKay's reasoning behind why he wants to do it immediately. We can piece it together because we're intelligent human beings, you know, but it isn't told to us with words. We can just see him get ignored and then him be like, fuck this guy, I'm going to my office and I'm getting some cameras, you know? But they never at any point say, you know, he's not like talking shit about Jarman to Peter Boyle halfway through the movie for just like, oh, he's so old, he stands on wooden staircases to represent the establishment, all this stuff. He stands in front of a giant poster of his own head while I stand in front of other people. You know, they're not like having these discussions where they're pointing out all of these things so that the viewer hears them. It's just, these are things that happen, and you can find them if you're looking for them, but you're never really told that there's been a shift. You sort of have to figure it out for yourself.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I feel like there's just that, there's five scenes that don't exist in the script of him, you know, up at night drinking and seeing Jarman on TV and like throwing a whiskey glass at a wall, you know, like all these scenes that, you know, just pull them out of the hat, whatever one you want, that just conveys this transition.
Yeah, I think those would be like, in most movies, there are, all of those scenes are him talking with his wife throughout the campaign at different stages. And those conversations happen, and the wife character becomes just a sounding board for McKay. And I think that's, in a regular movie that's made about politics in 1972, I think that's exactly what those scenes are. You know, it's exactly what you're describing, and he's having that conversation with his wife.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think the wife gets a more fair shake the way that this movie ends up portraying her?
Oh, I mean, I think one thing
from sounding board to just entirely absent for most of this movie.
Yeah, I'm not saying that women in this movie are treated particularly well. There's a lot of objectification of women in general. Like Redford's mistress doesn't get to speak on screen. His wife is almost entirely ignored for about an hour of the movie. Natalie Wood is basically a prop for a publicity photo, a bit of footage for the news. Yeah, I mean, it's not a movie that's great for women, but it's also a movie made in 1972. Like, this is, I'm not saying it's good normal, but it was normal. And I think at least something that I really love about this movie involves his wife at the this is probably after he's won the primary, like the Democratic primary, to become the candidate versus Jarman, when people are congratulating McKay, and then everybody shakes his wife's hand as well, and the one, like, everybody's basically commenting on Mrs. McKay's appearance, you know, and one woman I remember says to her, "You're lovely, of all the wives, you're the loveliest," and they're just sort of having the "Who are you wearing?" conversation, basically, and I think that's the that's something that's really cool and really modern and never really addressed, because I don't know his wife's name in this movie. I can't remember, which is why I'm calling her Mrs. McKay. But I do think that eventually she sort of works as a stand-in for McKay losing touch, because the last scene that we see of them together, they're just not even able to have a conversation, whereas they used to get along pretty well. There seemed to be some real passion between them. They're late for some sort of banquet because they just want to be together alone. And then the last scene we see of them together, they're also in a bedroom, and McKay walks out of the room, you know, and it just doesn't have anything to say. And she doesn't have anything to say to him. There's just a divide that has come between them. And that's the whole arc of his wife's character, you know, which is not a lot, but at least there's some sort of meaning to it, you know?
Yeah. And at least we get spared the adultery nudity sex scene, mm-hmm. with the woman he does cheat with, which, I mean, that's another scene that you kind of would have in the playbook, that, I mean, that whole plot point gets about 6 seconds and no one speaks about it in the film, right?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he, you know, he goes directly to this union meeting, or this meeting with this union leader. And even that one, you know, he just says, "I don't think we have shit in common." He has this opportunity to sell out a little bit more. You know, there's this, you know, the scene is throughout cinema history where he says what he believes, and the union man says what he believes, and what McKay is going to have to give up for him to get his support or whatever other benefits he's offering. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't do it. And the scene just ends there. And it's a different way to do it. And we understand eventually that he must have done something for them to get on the same page. And it's not the union man who budged, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think, I mean, who knows what Peter Boyle was saying to him before he even got in the room. Maybe he just saw that new haircut up close and was like, "Well, now I'm on board," you know? Who knows? Maybe he just sort of started to figure out, oh, maybe this guy has a shot at winning, and we're going to swing the vote, basically. But yeah, I don't have much to say about that, because like you said, they don't give you everything. It just sort of happens outside of the room.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely don't want to just, you know, hypothesize on the specifics of these business deals that, you know, we're not privy to. But mm-hmm. what, like, just because this is sort of a story that we've seen so many times, but it's told in this different way, and so many certain things are left out, and it is depicted so differently. Is it telling a much, like, is the takeaway different than all those, you know, various nameless other politics movies that we're talking about? Is it saying something different? I mean, is this watching this man turn bad, or is it that, you know, even the best kind of person can't stand up to the system? Mm-hmm. Or is it this notion that if he didn't change anything, if he did stay true, that he just would have lost, and we, you know, we'd be stuck with a worse candidate? Is there something different than the normal? Is this just saying the same thing in a different way, or is there something different that we're supposed to take away?
I think the things that I get out of this movie that I feel like are different, I mean, I'm trying to think of any sort of political film or movies about politicians from this time period in America, and, like, I mean, of movies that we've talked about on this podcast, I think the closest thing before 1972 is The Manchurian Candidate, which is a very you can't beat the system sort of movie. I think The Parallax View might even come out the same year as this, which we haven't done a podcast on yet, but it's something similar in that vein. I think what I think you're discussing about how you can't beat the system no matter how idealistic you are, or how much of an ideal candidate you might be. Like, it's Robert Redford, you know, like, he looks like the American ideal. And for 1972, like, the things that he's saying are very, like, as close to in line with what a liberal person in the early 70s would want out of a political candidate. But I think
and not even bad in retrospect.
No, not at all. Like, when they start talking about abortion in this movie, I was like, okay, well, here we go. It's about to be 1972. And it's just like, oh.
it could be a little bit firmer, but not bad for what I was anticipating.
Exactly. But yeah, like, as far as the system stuff, I feel like a lot of that is present in other movies. I think the way that we see that is mostly through the machinations and Peter Boyle's character. Like, the first thing we see in this movie is a close-up of a banner that says Atkinson, A Fresh Hope, who is the candidate that Boyle had been working for prior to going to work for McKay. And just that opening scene of Atkinson giving his concession speech, having to be pulled off a couch to go give his concession speech, and while that speech is happening, there's all of the campaign workers at the back just having drinks before the bar closes, basically, before they go off to their new job. And I think that is something that's really interesting and very not 1972, is starting the movie there and having the setup, and we get to the point where Boyle is in a cab about to go to California to meet his old college buddy McKay. And I think the guy that ends up doing the media stuff for them, the guy with the lollipops and the hammer, he says, nobody's going to beat Jarman. And then Boyle says, tell me something I don't know. We got the cab door closing, shot of a plane, title card. He's in California. And I think starting a movie like that and not starting the movie on Redford is really cool. Like, not starting with Redford's character establishment and whatever it is he's doing around that garage when Boyle ends up finding him. I think that is sort of the interesting thing about how this movie shows the quote unquote system, is that it shows the system before it shows the person the system uses. And but outside of that, pretty much everything else is pretty standard. And I think the thing that that I think really makes this movie valuable and really makes this movie interesting is primarily the internal journey that Bill McKay goes on throughout the movie, like, from being the person that he is in that scene by the garage or in his office eating Kentucky Fried Chicken while he's been convinced to join the race. That person, like, going from there to being alone in a hotel room with Peter Boyle again at the very end and just asking questions like, what do we do? I think it's that journey from point A to point B that makes this movie really interesting. And just in general, like, McKay talks about, again, this is after they've left the offices when they're in his home. I was just like, I just worked all the way through the weekend. I did this, this, and this. I'm happy. Why would I change? And Peter Boyle says to him, what did you accomplish? And he's like, well, he just listed these things that he accomplished. He also accomplished that he's happy, you know. And it's just like, something about the phrase, what did you accomplish, has to have sparked something in McKay. Again, McKay never vocalizes this. It's just some sort of like competitive urge that maybe Americans just have, or I say Americans as like, I mean, Canadians are basically nicer Americans. You know, I have that competitive urge as well. I don't know. There's just something wordless about just being challenged that in a lot of, maybe in a lot of men, maybe this is a masculinity thing as well, a traditional masculinity thing. It just sort of sparks something that you'll never talk about, but it's just like there inside of you. And it's just like, oh, somebody challenged me to do this. Okay, great. I'm going to do it, you know? And I think that's the thing that's really interesting, and the ways that the movie changes, basically any time McKay gets challenged, things get ratcheted up, because he can't avoid somebody saying, oh, this won't happen, or sorry, you'll never win this. Oh, watch me, you know, like that type of stuff. Or you know, when Jarman sort of just walks away from him multiple times in the movie, immediately McKay's like, all right, well, here we go. And I think that is the thing in this movie that is really sort of helped it maintain, like the fact that it is Robert Redford playing this character and that there is such an internal journey, but also an internal journey that's not really vocalized, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, on just on the topic of a lot of the last little bit we've been talking about, I want to read you something from Lerner, Jeremy Lerner, mm-hmm. The screenwriter we talked about. He said, Redford said, we want to do a movie about a liberal politician who sells out. And I said, well, I don't think people sell out as much as they get carried away. A campaign is so much bigger than the candidate. You don't have time to think of what you're saying. It's like floating down a river and you hear the sound of the falls ahead. It occurs to you you're going over the falls, but it's all you can do to keep steering the boat. And then he says, then he tweaked the actor. I told Redford, it's kind of like being a movie star. The role is bigger than the person playing it. And I really like that. I hope that he actually did say that to Robert Redford, even though it kind of sounds like something you might not actually say, but told people that you did say.
Yeah, I think what I know about Jarvis is that he seems like the type of screenwriter that would have actually said that to Robert Redford.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting quote.
Okay, yeah, I just think it does line up with a lot of what we've been saying, because it doesn't seem so much about this straightforward kind of fall from grace as he sells out on issue by issue, right? Mm-hmm. And just on that note, I want to know what you thought of his dad in this.
Oh, I love the stuff with his dad, because I mean, what is he trying to do? He's trying to be the new face, the guy that thinks differently, all these things. And who is the first person to congratulate him? And what does his father say to him? He just like descends, and there's just this shot of Redford in close up as his father descends and says, "Son, you are a politician." And just the cut to a close up of Robert Redford like taking that all in. And I love,
but
the
it's
stuff.
Not so dark and evil, right?
No, it's not, but it's there, and I love it. It's just the constant fear of not wanting to become your father in the case where like Bill McKay doesn't seem to have a great relationship with his father, and that sort of like old school men don't talk to other men about feelings sort of thing, like that sort of old school father-son relationship. But his father seems to know like what I mean, because he was a politician, he knows what he's going through when
there's just this pervasive like, I've seen some shit that yeah, I couldn't no, explain exactly. it to you, and you're gonna go through some of it and you'll never know everything. Mm-hmm. Just something about the way he laughs and yeah. just this kind of knowing smile, and get him a sandwich. Any man running for Senate wants something.
Exactly. Like, that was the line I was gonna mention. Because like that's something that's so perfectly ties into what I was talking about, like that inner desire that or the fire that's been stoked in McKay, and his father's just knows. He's like, we know that there's something here that you want, and we're just gonna keep giving you things or offering you things because I know that's what it is. And and I think it's just sort of his father saying, son, you're a politician, towards the end is a really good example of just sort of like, welcome to the establishment, you know?
Yeah. I'm gonna shoot this rabbit for no reason.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're, and then we're gonna cut to a close-up of you looking sad about it, but knowing that you can't say anything to me about it right now because you need me. You're gonna let that hatred of animals being killed just pass for my endorsement. Yeah, and that stuff's great. And just to go back really briefly, we can keep talking about the father if you like, but the part I forgot to mention about that sort of competitive fire, like the fire, and I think I forget where it is, where they Jarman's helicopter comes in and lands, and his campaign manager yells, the senator is about to make a speech or whatever, gather around. As he's walking away, it's almost a mimic of the first time we see Jarman and McKay together, where McKay gets sort of like brushed aside. He says to Jarman, I'm still hoping for a chance to debate you. Jarman says, I don't blame you a bit. And and then just walks away, which is just, that's such a nothing sentence. And then just like we did the rally earlier in the movie, we cut to a close-up of Redford, of McKay, but this time there is a raging fire behind him. And this movie doesn't try and do too much visually, but I think that is the perfect encapsulation of the sort of the subtle visual language of this movie, is that every once in a while they throw something in there if you're looking for it. But that is the perfect example of a visual metaphor. But it's also something that in a lot of movies could be so over the top and feel uncalled for and just like being talked down to. But I know I didn't think about that the first time I watched it 5 years ago or whenever it was.
Yeah. And I wonder if, I mean, this is 2 years before Watergate. Mm-hmm. I wonder if a lot of this stuff that we're talking about it being, you know, more naturalistic and without seeing these like heavy scenes and without seeing these, you know, moments of, you know, selling out your ideals and personal failures, if this movie after Watergate just has so much more of that kind of fire and brimstone and these straightforward scenes of people in government letting down their constituents and doing things that they know are wrong. I wonder if this kind of got in under the wire as, you know, just one of these smaller 70s movies that, you know, just kind of plays it kind of fast and loose, and things are, as we said, kind of not right down the middle, and has a bit more, you know, not fun, but just a bit more unpredictable. And if people making this were more caught up, and it's not that I don't think the people making this movie were passionate, because I think they chose to make this movie because they want to make a movie just like this. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if it was just a bit more partisan and a bit more, you know, the fire is a bit more stoked if this movie looks a lot different.
Yeah, I really don't know, because I think with the people behind this movie, like, I think, but like we mentioned Downhill Racer earlier, like that's a movie that's very much about the competitive spirit as well, just in sort of a different arena. And Michael Ritchie throughout his career made lots of movies about sports in a lot of different capacities, very few of which I've actually seen, but just anytime you're making a sports movie, it's a movie about competition in some way, and or feeling competitive in some way. And the screenwriter, we don't have Larner, we don't have a long record of, he didn't write a lot of movies, and so we don't have a lot of things to compare it to. So we're stuck with Robert Redford, who is also a producer on this movie. You know, we see it's a Redford Ritchie movie, in the same way that All the President's Men would eventually be a Robert Redford Pakula film, Alan J. Pakula being the director of All the President's Men. But I don't think even All the President's Men, which is the closest thing for a comparison for what you're talking about, I don't think that has too many like really over the top sort of sequences where the politicians are just absolutely villainous, you know. It's just known. And and I think continuing on that Redford example, 3 Days of the Condor is the other, I think, a movie that was made between those two movies, between The Candidate and All the President's Men, where it's sort of an abstract look at don't trust the government in any capacity. And there are definite like shadowy noir type villains in that movie that work for the government. But even then, I don't think it's hard for me to remember a specific sequence where it's the type of movie that I think you're describing. I think it's weird, because I feel like Robert Redford is like a very earnest person in general. I feel like when he gives an interview, I feel like he means what he says. And I always sort of project on him that he would be the type of person to sort of characterize a movie that way, like the way that you're describing the post-Watergate version of The Candidate. But I think he deserves credit for not doing that, you know, just as I'm sort of talking it through right now. And you know, if you look through his career, I mean, there are lines that are not subtle that you can draw through his interests. But more often than not, the output ends up being more subtle than I think what I would have assumed a movie star producer would sort of turn these movies into. You know?
Yeah. So, speaking of villains, did you see they offered James Stewart the role of Crocker Jarman?
No. Oh, man.
Yeah, and so he turned it down, apparently, this is what I've read.
Yeah.
He turned the part down because he thought it was too derogatory towards conservative politicians. So I guess he just didn't like the way that Jarman was written out.
Yeah, and Jimmy Stewart was famously a conservative gentleman as well.
Yeah, and I think a smart guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I just had this idea, the hypothetical of... hypothetical of Jimmy Stewart playing Crocker Jarman, which, by the way, great name. That hasn't been mentioned yet.
Oh, no. I mean, we were talking about the bathroom sequence at the primary victory where they're, you know, you're going to have to talk to more people. That's another example of sort of like a visual metaphor that goes sort of unspoken in this movie. Like, you're going to have to talk to more people you don't want to talk to. You're going to have to do more TV. You're going to have to shovel more shit, you know? And he's sitting on a toilet while he's having that conversation. Crocker Jarman, like just the term croc, like, you know, just being a part of his name. Anyway, I'm sorry, Jimmy Stewart.
No. I mentioned that, yeah. The name thing, which I'm always happy to talk about. This movie, as, and this seems a little maybe antagonistic, knowing everything we know about Robert Redford, even what people in 1972 would know about Robert Redford. Mm-hmm. If he switched it and he made Jimmy Stewart the old incumbent Democrat, and Robert Redford played the conservative, kind of slowly losing his edge, mm-hmm. his way, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think Robert Redford would ever make that movie, but
because it seemed he just couldn't even bring himself to play a conservative for a little bit, or it seems like to play a conservative and just, you know, act him becoming a shittier person just seems, you know, worse.
No, I think it's just, I think, one of the things that Robert Redford figured out early on in his career is that he has to play characters that are kind of like him, and that's how he can succeed. You know, he's not a chameleon type actor, and I think he knows that. I think in his heart of hearts he knows that. I don't think he would say it in an interview, but you just sort of look at his career when he's been successful. He's not taking a big swing. You know, he's relying on his charisma and saying things that he believes, you know, like he doesn't want rabbits to get murdered. You know, I know the real Robert Redford is not a hunter. You know, he's a staunch environmentalist, you know, and I think he just sort of, he figured that out very early on, that the best way to navigate his career was to mostly play characters who are at least saying things that he believes, you know? So that's why I don't think Robert Redford would do the movie that you're describing, just because I think he was very ahead of ahead of his time on the self-awareness curve, or celebrity self-awareness curve. And as such, I don't think just would have played that character.
Yeah. And so this isn't a movie about McKay becoming a bad person. It's about someone with his politics doing the best he can in the system the way it is.
Yeah, I think it's the system swallowing him whole. You know, like I mean, that's the last shot of the movie is him getting taken out of an empty room by a throng of people that he now has to entertain. You know, I think that's what it is. The system makes him ignore, how the system sort of literally takes him away. You know, the last shot of this movie isn't just an empty room. And the idea being that Bill McKay will never be alone in a room again. Now that he's a senator. And, even before that, as they're trying to, get away, as McKay's like grabbing Boyle, is like, I need to talk to you for a second. I just got to get away from here. This is immediately after he's had the son, you're a politician now moment with his father. He's just like, I gotta get the fuck out of here for a second. Him and Boyle just are like trying to get away from all these people, and they end up in the service elevator, right? And they just hit.
But they're not supposed to be there.
Exactly. They hit number 22. And what, like, the guy, the guy working there with I think it's trays of food. I mean, that person could not be closer to sort of like the common man that McKay was supposed to be representing, right? Like his practice that he worked for in before he started running was called Community Legal Services, like just the most broad name. And it's just like, who's more of a common man than somebody working room service in a hotel, and they don't even address him. They just stand there, and when the doors open, they leave. They just sort of invade his space, don't acknowledge him as a person, despite the fact that he speaks to them directly, and then they just leave and go about their own business. Whereas the idea is that the McKay, an hour and 47 minutes previously, would have been having a conversation with this person, would have been trying to learn more about them, and I think that's the movie, and him sort of getting called brought into the system, and then that system literally carrying him out of the room, but sort of like forcing him out of this room at the end of the movie. I think is really important, and there's tons of little things throughout the movie where we see examples of him sort of just quietly buying into the system. Like Boyle at one point when he's about to go on TV says, "Change ties." Robert Redford says, "Why?" And before anybody even answers his question, he says, "Never mind." You know, like he's just like, "Fuck it. At this point, I'm just listening." There's the point where I think it's in the primary victory party where he gets called to take a phone call, and he says after the phone call, he's like, "I don't know what her name is, but I know she's writing us a check." Money has become more important than the woman's name that he was talking to. And that I think a very important moment is the montage of the stump speeches, where he's just repeating the same thing over and over again. And he knows it's a joke because he makes a joke of it in the backseat of the car in the next sequence, and that ends with the Nixon peace signs.
Yeah, no, that's something I definitely want to talk about because, I think that you kind of weave throughout this, and definitely some of the moments that you just talked about, is that even presenting a true image of yourself takes crafting, you mm-hmm. know, like just to repeat your talking point so much, to whittle things down into a soundbite, which we always talk about being the worst thing about politics, you mm-hmm. know, now, or everyone says it the last 30 years or whatever, that people do it because it's effective and that's the way things get communicated. So you kind of just have to play into it. And just to the way he does sort of resort to platitudes, and the way the nuances from his argument just sort of fade away. That's one of the things where you never see him, you know, selling out. It doesn't start with him saying, "I believe A," and then 60 minutes later saying, "I don't believe A, I believe B." Mm-hmm. It just kind of gets all mushy. And I don't think there is a better representation of that notion than that scene you're talking about, where he's in the back seat and he's just not making sense. You know, you can tell he hasn't lost his mind. I mean, we can. It seems the other people in the vehicle don't.
They seem concerned.
Aren't as confident as we are. But that's what it is. Like when he's just become this person who speaks words, and he doesn't seem to have lost sight of his goals, but just the hoops he has to jump through, just you can tell have kind of distanced these things that are really truly important to him, and why he, as you said, kind of was doing what he did at the beginning of the movie at generic good person industries.
Yeah, exactly.
Just that's got away from him, and that even without saying things that you don't believe, saying them over and over, or saying them in ways that can be consumed, just it drives this massive emotional wedge between you and your speech.
Yeah, and I think we haven't really talked about the way that the media is portrayed in this movie, which I think is worth talking about because it's really cool. I enjoy how much of this movie hinges on the existence of the media machine, all these things, and just little moments like when McKay's speaking early in the film, you can just hear this piece of audio of somebody saying, "Okay, cut, we've got what we need," to talking to his camera crew that's set up for the speech. It's like, okay, we've got the sound bite. We've got him wanting to hear that healthcare bit, and then the ad cutter, the lollipop man has to explain to him, well, there's a baby crying, a woman slaps her child, all these things. This is why we can't use it in a commercial. And what you're saying about soundbite political culture is perfectly distilled in Boyle saying, "Can a senator fire the board of whatever?" I don't remember what he says. And that says it's meaningless. And the ad man says, who cares? It sounds good, you know? And we even see them as a collective, like early in the film, going and standing outside of the factory as the shift change happens. And McKay is trying to talk to people, trying to do it his way, trying to get good answers that we can actually, or that they can actually build into an advertisement for himself that is the exact opposite of what Jarman's doing, which is just a very traditional stoic, and he looks kind of shifty in these ads, just sort of set up direct address sort of things. And what McKay wants to do is just have conversations where cameras just happen to be present. He doesn't want to roll up in a car. He wants to walk up the last 10 feet away from the car because he doesn't want to be perceived as the person who arrives in a car. He wants to take a sip of that person's beer, you know. He's like,
or get dropped by a helicopter.
Yeah, exactly.
He wants to get punched in the face by someone while he's holding a hot dog.
Yeah. Just all of these things. And I think that's really cool. And also the one sequence that uses the media that I haven't mentioned yet is the debate sequence, where the televised debate, where we've got McKay and Jarman. There's a moment where they're at a commercial break and we see a shot of the control room of the TV station, and the camera operators are like getting directed as to what their shots should be when they come back from break. They're like lining these shots up. We see this brief moment of the two faces dissolve together as each camera operator has McKay centered on his camera, and the camera operator that has Jarman as their responsibility has Jarman centered, and it's just each of their faces are on simultaneously. And then of course we get McKay framed on the left and Jarman framed on the right of vice versa of the screen. And it's just sort of like this, they're constructing the way that the debate is seen. And I mean, that's also just, that's the way any sort of television program where it's a conversation between two people is framed. Like, if, no matter what segment you're watching on the National or whatever, camera operators are doing the same thing. It's just one person's framed on the left, one person's framed on the right. It's just how it is. But I just think the showing the actual nuts and bolts of that is very cool. And also the moment in the mall, which we've discussed briefly, where the microphone just isn't working, I think is cool, because sometimes these elements falter and you can't get your message across because you're just like, whatever, I'm gonna go have my sad sandwich handed to me that I'll put in my pocket.
Yeah, and all of that, all those scenes like that as well function as just a reminder of how much media plays a role in shaping all of this stuff. Like the just kind of the cameras running around them, and how many times we get a light right into the mm-hmm. lens. Mm-hmm. And
just the handheld style of the movie, like,
You kind of never forget it, even when you don't see cameras.
Exactly. Like, handheld camera work in 1972 is not this prevalent, you know? Like, now it's just like, it's a standard. It's like, okay, we got to get this shot and the sun's going down, get the camera off the goddamn Steadicam. We got to make this work. And it was just, you know, cinema was just so much more stoic back many decades ago. And, you know, the dollies and stuff exist, but yeah, the handheld is just not a popular technique at this point. And it's just most of this movie is shot handheld.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's reasons for that. But I think one of them just is that reminder that this is becoming such a big part of politics.
Yeah. And I should point out that there are moments in this movie where camera operators on this movie are on screen, you know, like where I forget, I think it might be Jarman after he votes is going to his car, or maybe it's McKay's father, and there's just a camera, like we see a close up walking with them, and then we cut to a wide shot, and then there's the camera right in his face. And it's like, okay, well, they were just shooting the wide and the close simultaneously. And it totally works. It works in this type of movie, because of course there would be more than one camera around. Like it just never breaks the logic for us. And it just is convenient for the director. It helps him get two shots without having to worry about where to hide the second camera, you know?
Yeah. Where, and just thematically about, you know, blurring these lines between reality of the who the politician really is, and who, you know, where the person begins and the politician ends, and just how infused communication technologies become into the whole election process. It's, as you said, like it's perfect that wall is malleable or not there for mm-hmm. what this movie's trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have anything else on the candidate?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I kind of want to talk. I want to briefly bring up like Redford, because in general, like, and the idea that he is a producer on this movie and the idea of the movie star producer, because anytime we get an opportunity to talk about it, we will. Like, the Mission Impossible podcast that we did this summer was more about Tom Cruise than it was about Mission Impossible, right? Like, it's something that interests both of us. And
Yeah, I'll briefly say that the trailer of this movie does have the exact same feel of this movie.
does it?
And
Okay.
so yeah, if you watch it, just not super strict on plot narrative and more just kind of disjointed, and it's still linear and everything, but it is a very representative trailer of
What the
what you're
movie
getting
is.
into. So I think it's effective in that way, and that they this movie feels the way it does because they wanted it to, and it was marketed as such.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I know I'm now commenting on something I have not seen, which is a no-no in my book, but The Candidate is all about changing who you thought you were on the fly. But I don't know, I think like a trailers, I think if you watch any movie trailer from 1972, it's not going to look like the trailer you anticipate, and it might always look like it's selling like a movie like The Candidate, where it's just like clip, 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 maybe a little bit of text. Like they're not the trailers that we are now used to seeing. But that is interesting, and I would imagine that a studio would try and sell would not try and sell most movies like it's the style of The Candidate. So I'm certain you're right, you know? But just the idea of this movie being about somebody being swallowed up into a machine, partially by choice, partially by a choice that he may or may not feel is a mistake. I just think that's so interesting for Robert Redford to be doing basically 3 years into the point of being super famous, you know? And like, I think maybe less than 10 years prior to this, he's just on stage in New York in a Mike Nichols play, you know? And he's Broadway famous. He's not Hollywood famous. And all throughout his career, Redford has had so much power over the movies that he's wanted to be in. He's a notoriously fickle person when it comes to actually committing to be in a movie. Unless it's exactly right to him, he's not going to be in it. And that has been true for decades and decades. And I just think it's so interesting that so early on in his career, he has this sort of perception of Hollywood. Because I think like anytime you're producing a movie, there has to be something personal about it for you. I think anytime you're acting in a movie, there's probably something personal about it, but it can also just be like, I'm interested in politics and want to do this research. I want to learn about this type of person and try and portray this type of person. Whereas I feel like every time Robert Redford produces a movie, there is something about his own life in it. It's not necessarily a research thing for him. And that's why I think so many of his characters are kind of similar in what I was saying about how I feel like he has to play characters that sort of say things that Robert Redford would say in regular life. You know, I feel like so many of his characters are just close to him, and we see it all as artifice because he looks like artifice. You know, like he's so beautiful that like he looks like he was made in a Hollywood lab, you know, and all these things. And I just think it's really interesting that, 3 years into being super famous, this movie comes out about him being like, oh, what if I made a mistake? What do I do now? And I just think that's really interesting. And in any interview that he's given, I watched a bunch from various time periods, he's always said, I felt like, you know, he gives the whole the acting bug sort of speech. Like he just felt like he was an actor. Like there's one thing every human being's meant to do. And he was an artist earlier on, like a painter, and he just sort of felt like he had to be an actor. And I believe that, but I just think there's such an interesting line of self-doubt that runs throughout Robert Redford, throughout his career, throughout him as a person in interviews. As I said, I think he's very honest and very human in that he's almost constantly doubting things he says. He's very fickle. Like, I mean, with The Old Man and the Gun, he said it was his last movie, and then like 3 weeks later, he's like, "Well, I don't know about that," you know, like, and just all of these things. He just feels like a, despite looking like, again, somebody that was made in a Hollywood lab and somebody who is a good actor, but like, you know, nobody's gonna confuse him with Daniel Day-Lewis sort of thing. He's just had such an interesting career. and has used his control and over his own career in such interesting ways. And I just sort of think that it's amazing that this is a movie made about a machine swallowing a human being, an idealistic human being whole. And as a young man or youngish man, him just being like, oh, what have I done? And just not being able to turn back because, son, you're a politician now. And I just think that's amazing. You know?
Yeah, no, I think that is. I think that is very interesting for him, as you said, to kind of be this would just be a time when so many people would just be so so happy and maybe getting lost and being as successful as he is and not contemplating that. If he's this successful, could it be the wrong thing? But he was still, that's still where his mind was.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't have that period of his life where he's just partying and crashing cars or anything like that. Like, you know, and maybe it's because he got famous as he was 30 or however old he was when he got famous. And he was just slightly older than somebody like, I mean, I mentioned Shia LaBeouf earlier, continuing that comparison. That's obviously where the car crash reference came from. But yeah, it might be an age where he got famous sort of thing, or it just might be he's just different. And I think it's probably a combination of both, because Robert Redford is certainly different. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So thanks for listening to The MacGuffin.